Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad you could join us for a little discussion about baseball cards as we wrap up the big old binder. It seems like yesterday we just started the big old binder. Looking at that one beat-up 1954 Topps Joe Coleman card that I have. Ever since then, we moved on through from 1957 through my collection. We wrap it up with 1980. And one of the least likely people to throw a perfect game, our random pull, card number 227, Len Barker, or Large Lenny, as he was known. We'll talk about not only his perfect game from 1981, but that is what he is best remembered for, and he is perfectly fine with that. So we'll talk about Len Barker, and we'll talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and we'll talk about 1980 Topps, the last set that Topps produced before getting competition in 1981. But first, we have to dive into why this was the last year that Topps could do something with little competition. As Topps knew that this day was going to be coming. In fact, we talked about it just a little bit in our previous podcast on 79 Topps. Topps emblazoning the front of the card with the Topps logo, first time they had done that in their company's history, and the design suffering a little bit, not a bad card, but just one that wasn't quite as creative or as innovative as some of the other sets from the 1970s. And you could say the same thing about 1980 Topps. There are actually a few things that are good about the 80 Topps set, which we'll get into, and 80 Topps product that is still out there, unopened wax packs and cello packs and rack packs and wax boxes are still very popular with collectors and still relatively affordable. It's just not quite, you know, it's not a 1976 Topps set. It's not a 1972 Topps set. 1980 Topps fails to reach that bar that was set before. But it was part of that dry period that we've discussed before. Topps starting to run out of fumes a little bit in the late 70s, and certainly once the 80s started. The good news for Topps was, especially in 1981, and you could say 1982, the new competition in Fleer and Donruss was such an inferior product that Topps was the best of the worst. And then finally, everybody got their act together in 1983 and started producing some pretty quality products. But for 25 years, from 1956 through 1980, Topps was pretty much the only brand of officially licensed, officially recognized, quote-unquote, real baseball cards in the market. And for the U.S. government, that was a bit of a problem because, as it turned out, Topps not only had a monopoly on the baseball card market, but for about 15 of those 25 years, Topps was colluding with the Major League Baseball Players Association to make the market the way it was. And both sides benefited financially rather well. And both sides would benefit financially with competition starting in 1981. But it's pretty amazing how Topps and the Players Association got to this point. And I wanted to start this show with some details on this because I spent probably about an hour yesterday looking through the court documents from the 1975 lawsuit between Topps and Fleer. And this is a lawsuit that dragged through the courts for 5 years. A decision wasn't handed down until July of 1980. And like I said, Topps was starting to see the writing on the wall. They could tell by 1978-79 that things were probably not going to work out well for them, not only because this case dragged on for so long, but the people at Topps clearly knew what they were doing with the Baseball Players Association. Cy Berger, who was the head of Topps at the time, he knew the shenanigans that the company went through to put themselves in this position. And of course, Marvin Miller, then the leader of the Baseball Players Association, he knew quite well the situation. So it was one of the less kept secrets, certainly wasn't a best kept secret within the hobby and within Major League Baseball. The day was going to come when Topps would have to face competition. It wasn't a matter of if, it was just when. And after the 1980 season was when it would happen, as this ruling came down in the summer of 1980. So I spent about an hour looking through copious pages, and I mean like 65 pages of court documents. And I'm going to try to boil it down here just so that you have an understanding of what happened in the mid to late 70s, how the competition came around in 1981, and how Topps ended that monopoly in the baseball card hobby slash business with a bit of a whimper with the 1980 set. Now, even though I'm mentioning the mid to late 70s and 1980 and 1981, this actually all goes back to the early 1950s. And as I've said before in this podcast, and perhaps you've read this in various books, there's a lot of great books about the beginnings of the hobby. This really goes back to the battle between Topps and Bowman in the early 1950s. So Topps and Bowman had competing products in the early 50s. Cy Berger comes up with this great design for baseball cards, the 2.5 by 3.5 inch size, the shape of the cards, how stats were presented on the back, how photography was used on the front. And basically, the elements of baseball cards in 2017, they were set back in 1953. I mean, this is a guy who was way ahead of the curve on design elements and what would be a popular pocket size presentation of the baseball card, which up until the early 50s had seen many different shapes, sizes, presentations, artwork, photography, statistics, advertisements. Well, the Topps company was able to nail that down in the early 50s. What they were also able to nail down in the early 50s was contractual agreements with ball players. And the way that Topps outmuscled Bowman was Cy Berger would actually go to spring training camps, which back then were primarily located in Florida. You had some in other far-flung outposts, but in the early 50s, most teams trained in Florida. You had a few out in the West Coast, but mostly in the Sunshine State. And he would camp out in locker rooms and hand out these contracts and sign these guys for a pittance. And if you were a minor league player, you signed a contract for $5. If you were a major league player, you signed a contract for $125. Now, there were some stipulations with these contracts. If you were the minor league player, you were signed to this contract for the first 5 years of your career, however and whenever they were. So you may languish in the minor leagues for 6 or 7 years and still have this 5-year contract hanging on you. Now, you would get the $125 for signing that contract for that year. But basically, you know, you signed your life away with your personal likeness when you were an 18 or 19-year-old kid in the minor leagues. Also, it should be pointed out that, you know, with $125, that was across the board. So Mickey Mantle would get paid the same as Dick Williams. And that's a little unfair, you know, no ill wills towards the late Dick Williams, but you get my point there. The star players were signing for the same rate as the utility guys, as the players who only got cups of coffee in their major league career, and that was it. But Berger and the Topps company were very aggressive. They would get these players to sign these contracts, and they would hold them for a very long time. Not only did they lock them in for the first 5 years of their major league service, whenever those years played out, but also player contracts were typically 2-year contracts. And that was very smart. For one, the Topps company would buy an extra year on that contract. Two, that basically kept the competition always playing catch up. Once a player signed with Topps, the other baseball card manufacturers would have to wait 2 years for the opportunity to have a player sign with them. Well, because Topps was so aggressive, and let's be honest, in the early 1950s, $125, yeah, that's nothing to sneeze at. You know, ball players were not making a lot of money then. So if you were in the major leagues and somebody said, sign this paper for $125, you did it. And, oh, you got a stack full of Topps baseball cards because of it. And, you know, minor league players, they didn't care about the $5. They didn't care about the five-year rule on you know, getting the money back, you know, in subsequent sets of baseball cards. They just wanted to make it to the major league. So, yeah, sure, I'll sign this paper and they'll forget about it. And, of course, baseball cards, they were just being collected by kids who were, you know, back in the early 50s, really just buying the gum, and the card was an extra throw-in that often got clipped to the bike spokes, and the rest is history there. So it was a very odd situation, an odd setup, but it was Topps really taking advantage of the situation. And because they did that, and because they were aggressive, Bowman was never really able to catch up with Topps getting the superstar cards. That's why when you look at the sets of the early 1950s, Topps has certain players, Bowman has certain players, and there's rarely crossover because these were exclusive contracts. So Topps eventually buries Bowman and buys out Bowman after the 1955 season, and Topps still to this day owns the copyrights to the Bowman brand and has so since 1989. And as we've discussed before, the Bowman brand pretty much exclusive to the rookies. It has become the set of the rookie card collector ever since the early 1990s and is still very popular in that role. Yeah, they've got some major league players scattered throughout the set, but the reason why you buy packs of Bowman is because you're trying to pull not only the special insert cards with autographs or game-used memorabilia, but you're looking for that rookie card of the guy who probably isn't going to be playing in the major leagues for another 4, 5, 6 years. You know, there's added value attached to those rookie cards that were released well before the player becomes a star in the major leagues. So Topps enjoys this monopoly and is first challenged by Fleer in 1963. And as we discussed in our 1963 Topps podcast, and I discussed it briefly, but Fleer comes around, and Fleer had been trying for years to do a baseball card set. They did an exclusive set with Ted Williams in 1959. It was a very boring set because Teddy Ballgame was near the end of his career, and it was, I believe it was a 60-card set featuring highlights like, you know, Ted eating breakfast before game time. I mean, it was supposed to be like a day in the life of Ted Williams, and it just was not executed real well. And Fleer had also come to deals with retired baseball players. That was pretty much the only market they could get since Topps was continuously wrapping up all of these players, the existing current ball players, in these two-year deals. Well, in 1963, Fleer decides, okay, Topps has this monopoly on the confectionery side. And if you look at how Topps cards were marketed back then, it wasn't Topps baseball cards. It was Topps bubblegum with picture cards. So Fleer says, all right, we're going to make sure that we put out something that you can't really count as a confectionery item. It has to be a low sugar, not bubblegum or candy item. So the insert in the 63 Fleer packs was a cookie that was so low in sugar content and had to be so dry so as not to damage the cards inside the pack. It was essentially a dog biscuit, or as we mentioned in the podcast, hardtack, that lovable teeth-breaking biscuit-like item used in the Civil War out in the field. So that's how Fleer thinks they're going to get around Topps' dominance in the market. Topps says, no, sir. And long story short, they're able to get the production of the 63 Fleer set shut down in the middle of the season. So Fleer had challenged Topps before with some sets that kind of skirted around the current ball players, with a set in 1963 that skirted around the whole confectionery issue, and with little success. So let's move through the 1960s. In comes Marvin Miller as the head of the Major League Baseball Players Association. And Miller is trying to build up the Players Association to be not just a loose group of players and executives. He wants this to be a legitimate business that is working in the best interest of the ballplayers. And part of that is you have to have a fancy office. It needs to be in a high-demand area in the middle of Manhattan. It needs to be properly staffed. Basically, Marvin Miller needs to raise a bunch of money very quickly. So in 1966, the Coca-Cola Company comes to the Baseball Players Association and says, we would like to use the likeness of 500 Major League ballplayers, and we would like to print it in the underside of the caps of Coca-Cola bottles. And Miller says, yes, you know, he basically uses collective bargaining here. It says you can use the likeness of 500 Major League ballplayers, and we're going to get a cut of the proceeds. And basically that turns into a big cash windfall for the Major League Baseball Players Association. And the light bulb goes off in Miller's head. He goes, wait a minute. You know, we made tens of thousands of dollars off of this promotion with Coca-Cola. So why shouldn't we collectively sell the use of the likeness of our ballplayers for other products? So Miller starts poking around and he sees the deal with Topps. Now remember, Topps, since the early 50s, had been going into Major League locker rooms and spring training, individually signing these players to these deals that were renewed every 2 years, and that helped keep out the competition in the baseball card hobby. But what it also did was it stifled the economic growth for the players who were signing these contracts. While baseball cards in the mid to late 60s was nowhere near the business it is now, or was nowhere near its explosion during the junk wax era in the late 80s, it had grown significantly since Seiberger went around to these spring training locker rooms in the early 50s and started this process. So Miller sees what's going on here. And at first he tries to negotiate with Topps, hey, let's work out this deal where you buy the rights to the collective licensing and we're going to raise the rate here. You know, the players have been dealing with the same rate for many, many years. And Topps says, no, thanks. Well, Miller, who, if you know anything about the late Marvin Miller, was a very hard negotiator, to put it nicely. There's no mistake that a lot of baseball's most contentious work stoppages, not including 1994, but throughout the 70s and early 80s, it was because Marvin Miller drove a hard bargain in every single deal. So you have this battle going on between Topps and the Players Association. The Players Association wants to collectively sell the player likeness rights, and they also want a bump in the pay. And Topps, you know, they've got a good thing going. They don't want to change it. So in 1968, Miller starts instructing the players, don't sign these contracts. You're getting ripped off. You can get more money. And the way we get more money is by working together as a group. And the players buy it. And Topps is now starting to sweat because these players are not signing these contracts. And you're starting to head towards 1969. You're going to have a major expansion in baseball with four teams coming in. And there's going to be more and more players that are going to have their likeness used in cards, not just in 1969, but beyond, when Topps would expand the sets to include the players that come up through the systems of Kansas City, Seattle, Montreal, and San Diego. So Topps is sweating a little bit while the negotiations start going a little faster. And by the end of the 1968 season, Topps has an agreement in place with the Players Association. Okay, fine. You can collectively bargain with your players to sell a collective license to us, which we will purchase. And yes, we will raise the rate to, I think they doubled the rate. It was like $250 a year. And then it was, it would be gradually increased over the term of the contract. And the term of the contract was another key thing. Instead of these individual player contracts every 2 years, the Players Association and Topps agreed to a five-year deal. So they signed that going into the 1969 season. In 1974, the contract is extended up to 1981. So that takes us to this lawsuit between Fleer and Topps. And I hope you're still with me here because there's a whole lot of information. But it's key to understanding where Topps was in 1980 as they were getting ready to give up the monopoly. So Fleer in the early 70s, they're trying to get back into the baseball card business. And they have an idea. They think, okay, we can't win in the confectionery battle. And because Topps and the Players Association has this agreement, we need to come up with something that is baseball card-like, but isn't really a baseball card. So Topps can't challenge us there. And we need to ask the permission of the Baseball Players Association to make this happen. So in 1974, they have this idea. Okay, we're going to do these 5-inch by 7-inch cloth patches of players. So think of it as a jumbo baseball card, which you would actually see. Donruss made these back in the early 80s. Basically, it was like a postcard size baseball card. But it wasn't cardboard. It was going to be cloth. And Fleer made a lot of things with cloth, you know, stickers, team insignia patches, stuff like that. So this was kind of the best of both worlds for Fleer. So Fleer goes to the Baseball Players Association, pitches them the plan, and says, can we do this? So the Players Association says, yes, but we need to talk to Topps because Topps has the first right of refusal on a project like this. So the Players Association goes to Topps, and Topps says, hell no, they can't do that. And that was actually a big factor in what would turn out to be the court's decision here. And that is, Topps had the first right of refusal to do a project like that with the Players Association. Topps did not, however, have the right to tell the other company, you can't do that. So that would be a big factor in the award that came to Fleer. And because of this botched cloth sticker or cloth postcard project of 1974, Fleer sues Topps and the Major League Baseball Players Association in a very, very lengthy, lengthy battle that, again, went on for nearly 5 years here. So to boil it all down here, the Topps company tried to make the argument that they still had the corner on the confectionery market. Nobody else can, and this was, you know, basically driven out of previous deals and court cases in the 1960s. They said nobody else can create a card that is 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches with a piece of bubble gum or other confectionery product in there. Topps would, make the argument, hey, you buy baseball cards on the candy aisle, and if anybody else tries to do something like that, there's going to be market confusion. It's going to hurt us. There's going to be an inferior product that's put out there. And there was even the argument of, okay, well, what if a competitor puts out a product that doesn't have that confectionery item in it? What if it has, let's say, a sticker in it, much like Fleer would eventually produce? And Topps would call that a sham product. No, a sticker costs less to make than a piece of bubble gum. It's just kind of this tchotchke that's thrown in there. And if you have a box of Fleer cards next to a box of Topps cards, people are going to think that they're one and the same. And people are going to think that, you know, the Fleer card is less valuable, thus it drags down the value of the Topps card because of their proximity in grocery store shelves. I mean, they fought tooth and nail to keep the status quo. And the courts decided against Topps, and they basically said, listen, you can't try to exclusively corner this market. Competition is a good thing, and even if Fleer puts out a product that doesn't include bubblegum, but includes, a throw-in that is similar to it, at least in terms of cost, then this is a good thing. You can't just corner the market here. And you know, Topps is like, well, you know, we're a bubblegum maker. And you know, there were there were surveys and data compilations in this court document that basically said that 3% of people who bought Topps products bought it for the gum first and then the baseball card. Oh, it just happens to be in here. So that fight didn't last real long in the court battle here. So Topps was fighting a losing battle. They knew it. They knew they were working with the Players Association to keep the competition out because the Players Association, through their tight association with Topps, they were making money hand over fist in baseball cards. Topps was making money hand over fist, and they didn't want to change it. Topps had a very aggressive sales team that pitched baseball cards, and the sales team would sell baseball cards not only to wholesalers, but to individual stores. By the late 70s, you had hobby shops selling baseball cards. Meanwhile, Fleer, they were a candy company. They made bubble gum. They made different varieties of bubble gum. That was pretty much it. They had a completely different approach to selling baseball cards. They just wanted it, next to the double bubble bubble gum in your local drugstore. They didn't aggressively directly sell like Topps did. So Topps cornered the market. The government knew this. Topps knew this. The Players Association knew this. So they knew that the end was near. And one of my favorite points in the court document, and I quote, "Topps' defense has been that it merely exercised its lawfully held contractual rights without trying to expand them unlawfully, and that the Players Association was solely responsible for foreclosing non-confectionery competition with Topps." Here's the best part. "Topps' position is a little like that of the boy who killed both his parents, later to throw himself on the mercy of the court because it was an orphan." Wow. "Topps' exclusive contracts foreclose all but a small slice of the market, and Topps has pursued a policy of objecting to sham," and that's in quotes, quote unquote, "sham non-confectionery products. Yet, it seeks to attach sole responsibility for market foreclosure on the association. Whatever the words contract combination or conspiracy mean must apply to the combination shown in this case." And the court would go on to say that basically Topps and the Players Association had this quote unquote interlocking agreement. So they weren't necessarily ganging up here. So, colluding isn't necessarily the best word here, but the Players Association had a deal in place with Topps that clearly served just the interest of the Players Association. Topps had a deal with the Players Association that clearly just served the best interest of Topps. Both of those deals did not serve the best interest of the consumer or any competition. So in July of 1980, this court decision strikes down the monopoly of Topps. And it says that by January 1st, 1981, the Players Association must offer a licensing agreement to the Fleer company. And also they need to open their doors to other companies that wish to make baseball cards. With 1981 coming, you had Topps, you had Fleer, you had Donruss all getting approved of by the Players Association. Also, this court ruling struck down the long-term agreement, struck down the exclusivity language that was in these contracts, so players could, through the Players Association, get baseball cards for various different sets. And also, it opened the door to confectionery and non-confectionery additional items here. So that's why the 1981 sets are the only sets to feature bubblegum in all Topps, Fleer, and Donruss. Now, Topps would go back in an appeals court and win the fight for the bubblegum inclusion. They still had, some data that suggested that, people associate bubblegum with baseball cards. It's something that has been, something that Topps was able to perfect over, almost 30 years of existence. And they were able to win that case. And that is why, starting in 1982, Fleer put in the stickers. And because of the stipulation of this 1980 decision, where the sticker quality had to be at a certain value compared to a stick of bubblegum, that's why the Fleer stickers are actually very nicely done. they're good pieces of art. They're quality stickers. If you get a sticker from a 1983 Fleer pack these days, if you stick it on a cardboard box, yeah, the glue may peel a little bit because it's 35 years old. But for the most part, it's still a quality item. All these years later, you could still stick it somewhere and it's probably going to actually stick and maintain its vibrancy depending on how you store it. So Fleer met that obligation. Okay, we're not going to put in gum, but we're going to put in this high-quality sticker. And then Donruss would go out with the Perez Steel Galleries, and they would have the puzzle pieces that made a nice big 8.5 by 10-inch photograph of a work of art, starting with Babe Ruth in 1982. So both of those companies met the obligation of, okay, if we can't put in bubble gum, we'll put in something that is, in terms of quality and cost, equal to the bubble gum that Topps puts in. And thankfully for collectors, that ended the really bad bubble gum that Donruss and Fleer had. You know, Topps gum was never nothing to get excited about, but Fleer and Donruss, they did not make a very good bubble gum product back then. So that's the backstory leading into today's set, the 1980 Topps set, which, as I mentioned before, is not a bad set. It's similar to the 1979 set in that there are some good elements to it. But it's not a set where you go, holy cow, I've got to buy some 1980 Topps cards. Now, there is a card that helps save this set, much like the Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card saved the 1982 sets. The Ricky Henderson rookie card in 1980 Topps absolutely saves this set. And after that, though, there's a pretty notable drop-off in rookie cards. I would say probably the next best rookie card, and we're talking about a card that's valued at maybe $8, is Dave Steeb's rookie card. One of the few cards with Steeb not sporting his cool mustache, his porn stash, from the 80s. The only other one was 81 Donruss, and that's probably because the picture of Steeb taken at the old Comiskey Park was from 1979. It was part of the old stack of freelance photography that Fleer and Donruss had to work with in 1981 to get up and running. But the Dave Steeb rookie card is probably the next best rookie card. Rick Sutcliffe in there as well also. Should mention the Mike Scott rookie card in there. But what 1980 Topps lacks in rookie cards, it certainly makes up for in star cards. Remember all the big rookie cards from the mid to late 70s, and that's Brett and Yount and Molitor and Mike Schmidt and Carlton Fisk, and you know, stars that carried over from the 1960s, Steve Carlton and Pete Rose and Nolan Ryan, Tom Seaver, Johnny Bench. So you have this pretty impressive collection of star cards here. So what 1980 Topps lacks in rookie power and certainly design power, which we'll get into, it makes up for in star power. So that is something that has kept 80 Topps going all these years later. Certainly the Henderson rookie card, but even if you don't get a Henderson rookie card, you've got some pretty good either mid to late career cards for the Ryans and the Benches and the Roses, or you've got some pretty good early career cards for the Brett and the Yount and you know, the players from the mid to late 70s who came about then. So there is a lot of star power to the 1980 Topps set, which is 726 cards. Let's take a look at our random pull. Card number 227, Len Barker of the Cleveland Indians. And we'll talk about Len and his very unlikely moment in time in 1981. But you look at this card, you see there's a lot of space given up to the border, a white border, and that's one thing that a lot of collectors don't like. But then you've got a pretty blah presentation here, where you have the player's name in the upper portion of the border, the slightly right center. And it's slightly right center because there is a small pennant in the upper left-hand corner that's kind of wrapped around the upper left-hand corner of the inside border. That is where the player's position was. And then in the lower right-hand corner, you have this sash, presumably going behind the picture, exiting out the other corner here with the team name. You have the faux autograph as well, covering up the full photograph, which takes up, or full color photograph, I should say, which takes up about, I'd say 85% of the front of the card. Now, speaking of the photographs in 1980 Topps, there were a lot of staged photos, much like this Len Barker card. Clearly, this is Barker at Cleveland Municipal Stadium, or actually, because he's wearing the road jersey, looks like it might be Tiger Stadium or Yankee Stadium, probably Yankee Stadium. As I mentioned before, Topps had a lot of photographs taken on the East Coast in New York or the West Coast in the San Francisco, Oakland area. But he's just standing here before a game, and his photo was snapped. He was still with the Indians in 1980, so they just decided to use this one. But there are some action photos in the 1980 Topps set, and some pretty decent ones, too. I know there's a Tim Foley action photo of him breaking up, or not breaking up a double play, actually, in the middle of a double play as a fielder, as a base runner is trying to break it up. There's a lot of action shots with bat swings, too. And, you know, like I said, the proportion of action shots to stage shots, probably 1-2. There's a whole lot of stage shots in this set, but the photography is not that bad. It's just the selection of photos, you know, probably could have used a few more action shots. But that was the basic design of the front of these cards. And basic is the key word here. It is very basic. Some collectors like it because it is, in their opinion, simple. Others don't like it, though, because, again, it's part of this downward trend of Topps design from the late 70s, now creeping into the 80s. But also, we've kind of seen this before. If you take a 74 Topps card and put it next to an 80 Topps card, they're essentially the same. But 74 Topps, we really enjoyed. So what's the big difference between the 74 Topps design and the 80 Topps design? Well, the best way I can put it is 1980 Topps put on a few pounds since 1974. And that's not just the size of the set, going from 660 cards to 726. No, it's just 1980 Topps. It looks like Topps is putting a medium shirt on an extra large body. And that's nothing against Len Barker here. I'm talking about these pennants. You know, they're just kind of flailing around here in the corners, where in 74 they were nice and neat and rather structured. Here they're just blowing in the wind. And it just looks like that, you know, putting 10 pounds of manure in the 5-pound bag. It just seems like it outgrew that 74 design, and it looks rather shabby because of it. So that's part of it. It's not a very creative design, and it looks like we've seen it before, and it's being stretched out in that medium shirt over the extra large belly. Now let's flip the card over. One of the few things I like about the 1980 Topps set is the backs of the cards, the color combination, blue. We haven't seen blue as the dominant color on the back of a Topps card really since 1965. Now you would see blue, you know, used in the ink of the stats in 1978. You would also see it being used slightly in 1975. But really, you've got to go all the way back to 1970, where blue was prominently featured just in the ink. But in the total color design of the back of the card, this is the first time in 15 years we've seen blue. And I've always liked that cool blue look. That's one of the big reasons why I like 65 Topps. That's one of the big reasons why I still give a lot of love to 86 Donruss, 88 Donruss, 91 Donruss. They use that same cool blue color here on the back. And despite the gray cardstock that Topps was using, it actually works. It kind of has, you know, if you've ever seen an old Pittsburgh Penguins sweater from the 1970s, before the Penguins switched their colors to black and gold to mimic the success of the Pirates and Steelers at the time. It's kind of got that look to it. It's a very nice and quite literally cool look to the card here. And you've got the blue and the black. It can be difficult to read depending on the print run, because sometimes the ink would come out a little too dark on the backs of these cards, and with the gray cardstock and with smudging, you could have that problem here. Not the case with this Len Barker card, however. Topps pretty much going with their typical layout on the back of the card. On the left-hand side, you would have a cartoon, often dealing with the player that is pictured on the front. Then you would have the complete stats on the right side, if space permitted, a little tidbit about the player. What was interesting, though, was the breakdown of the player's name and personal information for many, many years. The name and personal information was just featured at the top. Well, in 1980, Topps had the player's name, position, and team name at the top, and all the personal information, the, you know, which hand he threw with, his birth date, height, weight, all that stuff, was down at the bottom. And also, for the first time in a long time, Topps putting the card number not in a baseball-shaped spot on the card, but in a home plate-shaped spot on the card, still in the upper left-hand corner. So while the front of the 1980 Topps set left a lot to be desired, the back actually kind of lives up to my expectations. Love the color combination. It's a pretty standard layout for Topps, other than putting the personal information at the bottom, separating it from the player's name. But it works. The design works. The colors work. And despite some possible dark print runs that would make it a little difficult to read the backs of the cards, for the most part, you can read this information fairly well. So 1980 Topps overall, this was, as I've said before, kind of a whimper. You know, they didn't go out with a bang in their last year of monopolizing the baseball card hobby. It definitely went out with a whimper. Now, that's not to say this is a terrible set. We've seen some terrible sets prior to 1980. We've also would see some pretty terrible sets after 1980. But this is not one of them. This is just one that leaves a lot left to be desired. And I think collectors really wanted more. And this is really when the hobby was starting to become a business. You have more and more people buying baseball cards, and you just kind of leave them hungry. You leave them hanging with 1980 Topps. And I put it in the same category as 1979 Topps, a set that has some good attributes to it, has a big rookie card and some star power to it, but it doesn't really knock your socks off. You don't go tripping over yourself to get this set. Now, with that said, 1980 Topps is still rather plentiful, not junk wax era type plentiful, but you can still get packs and cello packs, rack packs, wax boxes, and you can get them at decent prices. Wax packs you can still find, depending on where you're buying them, I would say anywhere from $10 to $20 a piece. Certainly cello packs and rack packs are a little more pricey because you get more cards out of them. But this is also part of that window of late 70s to early 80s product that, while there's still a lot out there, it is somewhat rare to find it. So the prices do occasionally get jacked up just a little bit. But much like 79 Topps, and I would even stretch that back to 78 or 77, you could still find plenty of these cards at local card shops. They are not going to make big bucks for the card shop owner, with the exception of the Ricky Henderson card. Maybe the Ozzie Smith second year card. Most of these cards, the star cards, you know, the Schmidts and the Bretts and those, maybe you buy them for a dollar from the card shop. And all the other cards, you know, their commons, if they're taking up space, the card dealer may want to get rid of them for 10 cents a piece. So you could walk into a local card shop and come home with 200 or 300 1980 Topps cards for $15, $20, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. So while the set leaves a lot to be desired, I would say, even though you're not going to trip over your own feet to get it, don't run away from it. This is still a set that has that star power. And again, you know, it's 37 years old. It's starting to become vintage. If you get a chance to get your hands on some, I would say go ahead and do it. Just certainly do not overpay for the 1980 Topps set. Now, while you're looking at your 1980 Topps set, if you come along card number 227, you will find Len Barker, our random pull from our 1980 collection. And Len Barker is best remembered for being quite possibly the least likely to throw a perfect game in Major League history. It was big news in 1981, and it is still big news all these years later. I'm thinking of players since then who have thrown no-hitters or perfect games, rather. And the only other pitcher that I can think of that would seem least likely to throw a perfect game or a no-hitter, it happened in 1990, I think, or 91. And that would be Tommy Green, who was with the Philadelphia Phillies at the time. I believe he was in the deal that move Dale Murphy to Philadelphia. But anyways, Tommy Green was a young pitcher who didn't have a very lengthy career, but his one shining moment was a no-hitter back then, and Len Barker is pretty much in the same boat there. He was a third-round pick of the Texas Rangers in 1973. The 1973 draft for the Rangers, they had the first overall pick. That is best remembered as the David Clyde draft. The Rangers, looking to put butts in the seats at Arlington Stadium, went with the 18-year-old phenom and just threw him right out there in the major leagues, where he would, long story short, blow out his arm and pretty much ruin his career. In fact, he was pitching for Cleveland by 1980. But, you know, the David Clyde draft, it's not only because of the failure of David Clyde and the rush-up that the Rangers did to him, but also they could have, just a few picks later, they could have selected Robin Yount or Dave Winfield. So, if you ever want to play the what-if game, what if the Rangers selected one of those guys instead of David Clyde? Well, in the third round, they select Len Barker, who could really pound a fastball at the plate. But that was the key problem, getting it at the plate. Sometimes Len Barker would be a good 6 inches, or in one very memorable clip at Fenway Park, about 60 feet away from the plate. He uncorked a wild pitch that literally slipped out of his hands and went up the screen behind home plate. So the Texas Rangers, they see a lot of promise in this guy, and he starts out in the bullpen, has a couple of good cup of coffee seasons in 76 and 77. But by 1978, you know, it's not quite looking so good. He's going back and forth between AAA and the major leagues. Well, the Rangers are starting to improve as a team by 1978. So they make a deal after the 78 season with the Indians, where they trade Barker and Bobby Bonds for Larvell Blanks and Jim Kern. Now, it seems like a lopsided deal when you've got Barker and Bonds going for Blanks and Kern, but keep in mind, in 1978, Kern was an all-star reliever, closer, pretty good one, too. And Blanks was certainly not an all-star, but a serviceable utility infielder. Now, he would only have two or three more seasons left in him. But these were the kind of role players the Rangers were looking for as they were trying to battle Kansas City for a chance to win the American League West. And in 1978, they were starting to put themselves in that position. So Barker goes to Cleveland, and he has a pretty decent 1980 season. His earned run average is 4.17, so that's not what's decent. But he does have a career best 19 wins and 12 losses. He also throws 187 strikeouts, which led the American League at that time. Remember, Nolan Ryan had moved to the National League in 1980 with Houston. So Len Barker is your strikeout leader. And as I mentioned, he was able to pound that fastball in there. Well, along comes 1981, and that was a pretty unique season for a number of reasons. First, it was the, up until 1994, the biggest, longest work stoppage in Major League Baseball history happened, where about 2 months of the season went by the wayside, and right in the middle of the season as well. But Barker was able to provide a little spark of entertainment. On May 15th, 1980, there's literally just several thousand people dealing with the cold, damp, windy night at Municipal Stadium in Cleveland. Of course, there were a lot of those nights at Municipal Stadium in Cleveland, but it's one of those nights where the temperature is like 45 degrees, there's fog rolling in. It is just not a good night for baseball. And you have to wonder, those people who did show up were either diehards, had nothing else to do in their lives, or were quite simply masochist, because the Indians were not a very good team. The weather wasn't good. And the Indians that night were playing a pretty bad Toronto Blue Jays team. This is when the Blue Jays were starting to lay the foundation for the team that would become good in the mid to late 80s. But by 1981, it was still, to put it nicely, a work in progress. Well, that night, Len Barker, the guy that you would least expect to throw a perfect game, does just that. and he does it rather efficiently. The Blue Jays batters never worked the count to up to three balls, so Barker was never really behind in the count, never had to really struggle for this game. His bigger struggles were the weather conditions and counting on his fielders to make plays in the cold weather, in the fog, and they were able to do that. So he's able to get the perfect game. A funny quote from his grandmother, who was 92 years old at the time. You know, she's told about the perfect game, and a reporter reaches out to her and says, "Oh, what do you think of your grandson throwing a perfect game against Toronto?" And she says, "I'm very proud of him. I hope he does better next time." So we're setting the bar pretty high, Grandma. But that was one of the highlights for Barker that year. The second highlight was he was an all-star pitcher. He actually had one of his better earned run average seasons that year with a 3.91. And not only was it a good thing to be an all-star, but the all-star game was in Cleveland that year. Now, it was a little later than normal. In fact, it was in August because the work stoppage had stopped, and the all-star game was actually the first game out of the strike. So Barker was able to pitch a couple of innings in front of a crowd of over 72,000 people at Municipal Stadium. Quite the moment for him. Follows up 81 with a pretty good 1982 season. Goes 15-11, a 3.90 earned run average. And things are looking good for him. So good, where in 1983, the Atlanta Braves are making a push for a playoff spot. And of course, they were National League West division winners in 1982, so they're trying to repeat it in 83. Well, you want a guy like Len Barker, a hard-throwing starting pitcher, an all-star, somebody that can just come in, you can plug him into the rotation and have some success with him. Well, he is traded to Atlanta for players to be named later and $150,000. Well, the Braves complete the trade. Later on in the season, they send pitcher Rick Behenna, who didn't really have much of a major league career, and after the season, a couple of prospects by the names of Brett Butler and Brooke Jacoby. This would turn out to be one of the worst trades in Atlanta Braves history. And that's saying quite a bit considering the Braves had been on the wrong end of a lot of lopsided deals. Well, as it turns out, Len Barker is dealing with, just getting older. Because he threw so hard, he would slowly damage his arm. And his 1983 season with the Braves, while it was a pretty good short stint, and the Braves would fall just short of winning the NL West, 1984 was, I don't want to say a complete disaster, but it certainly didn't live up to expectations. He was dealing with injuries. He pitched in only 21 games that year. That's a far cry from what he pitched in the early 80s with Cleveland. And then 1985 rolls around, and that is a bona fide disaster season. And, oh, by the way, I should mention, after the trade, Barker signed a long-term deal that was one of the richest at the time. I believe he was getting just under $1 million in the season. But the Braves threw money at him, and he wasn't able to provide them value for that money. And again, it's not really his fault. It's just his arm starting to fall apart. And unfortunately, he wasn't even at the age of 30 at the time that this was happening. In 85, he goes 2-9, a 6.35 earned run average. Meanwhile, Brooke Jacoby is starting a career which he would spend mostly with Cleveland. He had a little stint with Oakland, but most of the time he was with Cleveland. Two-time All-Star, pretty decent power hitter on the hot corner for some Indians teams that weren't great, but provided some hope for Indians fans in the mid to late 80s. And then Brett Butler, he would be an all-star, believe it or not, only one time. It's hard to believe Brooke Jacoby played in more all-star games than Brett Butler. But Butler would have a very lengthy career. Not, I certainly wouldn't say an astounding career, but you know, he hit over 2,000 hits, averaged a .290 batting average for many, many years. And Brett Butler was a very serviceable, consistent player, not only at the plate, but in the field. So, you know, hindsight being 2020, this was just an absolutely terrible deal for the Braves to make. But it was a deal that they kind of had to make. You know, you have to give up prospects to get that, you know, rental player or that veteran player that you want to drop into a lineup. It's not all that different from what the Braves pulled on the Detroit Tigers a few years later, sending Doyle Alexander for John Smoltz. And Smoltz, you know, as we discussed in our 1990 FLIR podcast. Smoltzy was not really setting the world on fire then, but under the tutelage of Leo Mazzoni, we know how that career worked out. Well, it wasn't working out so well for Len Barker. In fact, the Braves decide to cut bait after the 85 season, despite him signing that rather lengthy contract. And let me get the numbers on that contract again. Yeah, he was making just under $1 million by the Atlanta Braves. 5-year deal that was just under $1 million. He averaged about $900,000 back then. So, you know, the Braves decide to cut ties with him. He signs as a free agent with the Montreal Expos, never plays for the Expos. He's actually in their minor league system for the entire 1986 and 87 spring training. He's cut by the Expos before the 1987 season starts, latches on with the Milwaukee Brewers, plays only 11 games with Milwaukee before his career ends at the age of 31. So his career numbers, nothing exciting here. 11 years of win-loss record of 74-76 and a 4.34 earned run average. So, you know, nothing that you look at and you go, wow, this is, you know, a tremendous ball player. But he had that one tremendous season in 1981 and that one tremendous moment, that perfect game performance in May of 1981 against the Toronto Blue Jays, something that he is best remembered by, and he's okay with that. It's kind of like the, you know, the singer that has that one song, you know, the one-hit wonders. Some singers, they don't like it. It's a curse to be labeled a one-hit wonder. Others, they're pretty cool about it. Like I met a long time ago, this is probably about 15 years ago, Eagle Eye Cherry. He had that song in 1997, Save Tonight. You still hear it on the radio these days. It was a staple song from 1997, and 20 years later, it still played in a pretty heavy rotation on a lot of adult contemporary stations. And I met him at a little performance that he put on for a radio station I was working with at the time. And before he sang, he's just like, you know, some people, they don't like being labeled one-hit wonders. Hey, I've got that one hit. You know, I've worked really hard for it. I'm so thankful I had that hit song. So many other people don't have hit songs, and they try and try and try. So at least back then, you know, like I said, this is about 15 years ago. Maybe he's bitter about it now, but as far as I know, he was pretty cool about it, much like Len Barker was pretty cool about being identified with that one perfect game. He is, at last check, a coach at Division II Notre Dame College in South Euclid, Ohio, and by all accounts, still loving it and still loving that association to that one special moment in the 1981 season. So there you go, our look back at Len Barker, the 1980 top set, and how we ended up in the situation of 1980 with Topps losing out to FLIR, thus opening the door to the plethora of baseball card companies in 1981, which would then be expanded in the late 1980s with the addition of, well, first of all, Sports Flicks. They were around for a few years, but more notably to Score and Upper Deck, the rebirth of the Bowman brand and the junk wax era. So for good or for bad, the monopoly ended in 1980, and it ended with a little bit of a whimper in terms of design for 1980. Now, based on your comments on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed here, 1979 was right up there with 1980. Let's quickly go through the timeline here. As Cardboard Clubhouse points out, while not my favorite set of the 70s, I prefer this more than some of the other late 70s offerings from Topps. And we saw quite a few people felt the same way there. For some reason, this is Ted Ziegler, for some reason I took 79 off from buying packs. Would have been in sixth grade. No major life changes. Looks like I dodged a bullet. Perhaps you did. CompleteYourSets.com, not a fan of 79 Topps. Worst set of the decade, in my humble opinion, black and white three-player rookies and tiny, hard-to-read card numbers. Doug McCready, 79 was my least favorite of the decade. Didn't like the star cards, and one rookie is not exciting. It prepared us for the nosedive ahead. Yeah, Topps would certainly go through some struggles over the next few years, as we've discussed. Now, some people did like the set. Andy Viker mentioning, my first year was 81, but my store had loads of 80 and 79. Also, I loaded up on the 79 because they looked the best of the worst. Sometimes that's how you have to make your purchasing decisions. Terrence Leaders, my first year of collecting cards. Loved the all-time record holders subset. Great mix of up-and-comers and all-stars, too. Love the show. Well, thank you very much, Terrence. Now, while some people liked the set and a lot of people didn't like certain elements of the set, one thing that collectors and listeners to the show liked was our random pull. Amos Otis, If You Build It, mentions old Amos was a big part of the 1980 World Series. Yes, he was. James Bowerly, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. My apologies, James, mentions that AO was fun to watch. And in fact, that nickname of AO grabbed the attention of some people. Sparty Hawk Cachet saying, "You had us at AO." And also, Uncle Dave, his Twitter handle is Sunglass Pro 80. In 1973, I wore a blue Amos Otis glove. The blue gloves, I remember those. Yeah, I used to have some pretty funky color gloves back then. I think my brother had a blue glove, or it was kind of a greenish blue glove. But I'm glad that we were able to bring back some great memories of Amos Otis, if not the 79 top set. And make sure you pass along the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed to your friends, those who collect now or those who collect back in the day. Keep an eye out on our Twitter feed for the next big auction break. We did a couple of 82 tops grocery packs. Sparty Hawk Cachet, our winner of that auction. And we posted the results yesterday on the YouTube, on the YouTube. Yes, on your YouTube.com TV channel is where you can find the results. Our next items up for bid this upcoming weekend will be two cello packs. We have an 83 Fleer cello pack with a Cal Ripken Jr. card on the back, and an 84 Fleer cello pack with Mr. Pete Rose on the front. So we will put those items up for bid this upcoming weekend. Also, take a look this weekend for our Flashback Friday episodes. And next week, a brand new podcast. I think we're going to go back to the big old monster box for a little bit. Our most recent survey said, don't go in chronological order, just pick any old card. And I think we're going to do that. It's been a while since we've been to the big old monster box. So we will, at random, just reach in there and pull a card out. So I don't know what year it is. I don't know what set it is. I don't know if it's good or bad. But we will all find out together next Tuesday, 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time, on the next episode of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for joining me, and we'll see you next time.